This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, great. I am so happy to be back here in the studio after this weeks and weeks of being locked up in the house, and so it's really wonderful to be back. And we're going to start having guests coming back to the studio in a few weeks. I've got quite a few authors who have been eager to come back because there is something absolutely so much fun about being in the studio and sitting behind the microphone. So I'm starting to book them, and I hope that everything is okay so that they can come in because they really want to be here in the studio with me. And so I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to, well, Thursday is my son's birthday, and I'm really thrilled that he's home with me for this wonderful event, because usually he's been either at university, or when he was younger, he was so often at summer camp, and it was difficult to get to him on his actual birthday. So I'm really thrilled that this year I will have him. Thank you. Sort of thanks to the quarantine, he comes down from Wisconsin, and next thing you know, he has to stay for 14 days at least, and he stayed longer, which is wonderful for me. And it's just, I can't tell you, I'm actually so happy about it. Now, I'm just waiting for some call-ins today. I've been so busy with everything going on here, trying to get the summer schedule organized, and I've been having lots of fun with the emails that I've been getting from you. I was really particularly honored and thrilled. I got an email from a woman named Christy, and Christy wrote me that she's been listening to the show for a long time, and she's checked out my webpage, which is radio-joyonpaper.com, and so she was looking at all of the people who have appeared on the show, and she wrote to me that she was inspired. Finally, she said, finally, as I was talking during the pandemic, that, you know, find that joy of writing and start writing. And so she actually started writing during the pandemic, and she is so thrilled. She has really been doing just a wonderful, she said she didn't know at first if she could even write 50 words a day. And, you know, I said, you know, 500 words a day is nice, 1,000 words a day. And she's now up to like 3,000 words a day, almost every day, at least 5 days a week. And she says that it's giving her so much happiness and so much joy, and she said that is exactly what happened to her, that she suddenly realized that she had all these ideas in her head for years. She never wrote anything down. She had never written a journal. She had never taken notes. And now, of course, she says she's sorry she hadn't taken notes over the years, because so many interesting things happened to her over the years. But she had never even, you know, she couldn't remember what year they happened because she had never taken notes. But now she's trying to go back and look at some of the events of her life, and she's writing a memoir. And she asked me about different memoirs that she should look at, and different sort of family stories, because she's not sure it's sort of combining her family. And so I told her about one which was written by Ray and Trish Arredondo, and it's called Maria's Journey, and it happens to be the story about Ray's mother's trip from Mexico, and when she came here to the United States and to look for a better life for her family. And it's an absolutely gorgeous story. They did a lot of research. Again, this happens when you decide to start a story, and if it's like a story of your family, if the records aren't there, sometimes you don't know where to start. But there are really so many resources, thanks to the internet, that we didn't have years ago. But today, it really makes it easy. So whether your family is from another country, there are records of them arriving in the United States. And if they were in the military, there are records about their service in the military. And of course, census records are very, very, very valuable. It's amazing what you can do. And of course, many people are doing the DNA tests, and then they get more information that way. And you can piece together all of this information, and really with the idea of making sure that all these stories that are in your family are not lost, and all the people who you treasure are remembered. It's a great way to do it. And so I hope that I really was really thrilled when Christy wrote me, and I told her that, you know, as she's progressing a page a day or whatever, that in a year or so she'll have a book, and then she has the opportunity to either publish it herself or try to find a publisher. Memoirs are more difficult to find a publisher for, but I'm going to be talking to Sharon Duckett, who wrote No Rules, and that's a wonderful example of a memoir. And so I'm looking forward to talking to her at the bottom of the hour, and I'm waiting now for a call in from, actually I think from Hawaii, but I don't know, didn't call in yet. No, and I don't know. So we're waiting for that. Hopefully he will call in. And meanwhile, I want to just again recommend some books. It's funny. I just in case they're late, Ed, pull up the one Glenn Erickson's promo, because I want to play that. people being stuck in the house and people thinking a lot about the future of mankind. I was impressed when I first read Glenn Erickson's book called Android Love. Now, let's hope that we're not going to get to that point. But the story is fascinating, and it opens up a whole question of what is artificial intelligence, what will happen in the future. And so I thought, you know, just for... It's a wonderful writing. It's, you know, he loves sci-fi, and he's been writing for quite a few years. He was a businessman who just wanted to write, and he found that joy on paper. So he's been writing, and this most recent novel, he's just captured a wonderful, warm story. It's not a very big book, and it's something that I think you would really enjoy. And it's also a good example of what an author who comes out with a character that you really care about. And Richard, his main character, is someone that you want the best for Richard. There's something, this is one of the books where I've gone back and I said, why do I like Richard? Why do I care about him? And it is exactly because somehow, and this is the joy of being a writer, when you just have the right character and you bring him to life. And in this case, it's in a book called Android Love. Let's play the promo, Ed, and then I'll come back up because we're still waiting for the call-in.
From the pen of local storyteller Glenn Erickson comes a tale of romance and suspense. A truck driver encounters a beautiful woman fleeing in the night. Why is she running? Who is she running from? When Richard stops to help her, he has no idea his life is about to change. His quiet life as a widower is turned upside down when he discovers that Marie, as she calls herself, is really an advanced android, one who not only has escaped those who created her, but who has become self-aware. She wants to be free. She wants to live. Can Richard protect her from the corporation that claims her as their property to do what they want with her? Will Marie be able to find justice before she's captured by a bounty hunter? Android Love is a new type of love story. Does an android have the right to feel love? To form an unshakable bond with a human that defies logic? The story of Richard and Marie will touch your heart and get you thinking about the world of the future. Are we prepared? Android Love, written by author and storyteller Glenn Erickson, is available on Amazon KDP.
Okay, well, and I want to thank Glenn Erickson also because he is a good friend to Joy on Paper. And now I'm really excited to talk to Robert McCaw about his third book in his series, set in Hawaii. And I mean set in Hawaii. He makes Hawaii come alive. And the name of the new book is called Fire and Vengeance. And the author, Robert McCaw. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hi, I'm terrific. How are you?
Okay, well, I'm happy that I'm back in the studio because I had like four and a half weeks broadcasting from a secret location in my house, normally my kitchen, and it's so good to be back in the studio.
Well, it's been such a, and is continuing to be such a an unusual and difficult time for lots of people, and I hope everybody who's listening to this is safe and healthy.
And yeah, exactly, because it's been a strain. And I hope that whether they're stuck in the house or they can get out there in the sunshine and get back in their hammocks and or get in the backyard or get on the beach, because here in Florida, they are opening the beaches again, they will enjoy your book, Fire and Vengeance. And the cover is really great. I love the cover. And this is exciting. You know, last time we spoke, we talked about Off the Grid, which I am one of those few people, I guess, in the world. I never had any desire to visit Hawaii. For me, Hawaii was what I saw, you know, on Waikiki Beach, the big hotels. And I hate that kind of thing. And then I read your book, and you brought Hawaii alive for me in a way that I had never even thought about it.
Well, it's one of the things that I really try to do in all of these books. I talk about two Hawaiis. There's the tourist Hawaii, which in many ways is phony. It's palm trees and hula dancers and Waikiki. And then there's what I call the real Hawaii, which is a complicated, ethnically diverse society with the most amazing geography in the world. And if you just look at the Big Island where most of the books are set, it has, six of the world's seven climactic zones, ranging from the top of Mauna Kea, where they get snow almost every year, to lush rainforests and desert kinds of environments. That, plus the fact that it's all on the Big Island, active volcanically and geographically. Within the last, starting in May 2018, Pele reared up and destroyed a lot of beautiful country. But at the same time, she expanded the Big Island. It's what's been going on for millennia. And I try to take readers inside all of that and let them see in various scenes and scenarios how people interact with that geography and with that volcanic history. I like to say that in many ways, the Hawaii itself is a character in the book.
It definitely is. It's there's another author who does the same thing where she makes the city where her book is located. In this case, it's Jill Block. She wrote a book called The Truth About Parallel Lines, and she is. When it comes to New York City, I really felt when I was reading that book that I was back in New York City, and I hadn't at that point been in there for a long time. And with you. Now, as I said, I had no interest before in visiting Hawaii, but first with Off the Grid, which opened with a wonderful scene, and now with the new book, this scene is amazing, too. the entire, it's like a new world has opened for me. I want to see it. I want to see the volcano fields. I want to see the lava fields. I want to see all of it for myself, because it's you describe it so beautifully.
Well, thank you. It's really fun to try to put that together with a story. I mean, that to me is the other piece of this, which is the story is integrated into the landscape. As you know from the opening scene of the book, the island and its violence, its volcanic nature is right there, and people are dealing with it. People are responding to it. And that's one of the things that makes the story really exciting.
It does. And of course, it's a great mystery. It takes us to on several levels. Why? I don't know how much you want to give away. You tell us what you want to tell about the story, so I don't give anything away. But the opening scene is definitely, dramatic.
Well, one of the things that I find interesting in life, and I try to bring to life in the novels, is this notion that we are all captive in some way to our past. That is especially the case if we have a violent or illegal past. It may be underneath the surface for a year or a decade or several decades, but it comes back. What people do comes back to haunt them. You can see that in the main character, who, as a teenager, killed his father's nemesis. Partially an accident, but he lives with this secret knowledge, and it affects what he does. It affects the way he investigates cases. It affects his kind of paranoia that he will be fooled like he fooled the cops after he killed his father's nemesis. And that history informs and motivates and drives his character in a way that makes him unusual. He's the killer turned cop. But it also motivates him to seek out justice for the victims.
Well, his name, of course, is Koakane, and he is, you've written a character who we really, we take to heart. We care about what he's suffering internally, and we care about the work that he's doing. As you said, he's going after the bad guys in a big way. He wants to right the injustices, and certainly in this story, it hits so many buttons of of evil that is encompassed in your storyline here.
Yeah, well, and the same theme comes, have worked into the bad guys here. I mean, it is their past that motivates and ties them together in the way that you find out ultimately in the book. So this theme of our past coming back to haunt us is really on both sides of the good and evil story. That's one of the things that I really try to accomplish in this is, and obviously, as we talked earlier, the making of Hawaii into a character. But I also try to bring in the very interesting and unique history of the island itself and of Hawaii itself. I mean, people think of Hawaii and they think of beaches. They don't think of a country, basically, that was an independent nation for 100 years, recognized by the rest of the world as an independent nation, and then essentially expropriated by the United States. And that affects the culture. That historical event comes back and affects the current day culture of the island. And I think you see some of that in the book as well.
Well, you mentioned hula girls, and I think, like, you know, for me, I thought, you know, it's not that interesting. But, oh, the history that you bring into your books, and I've gone back and I had already read, of course, book two, and I went back and read book one, which is Death of a Messenger. And so it's amazing to discover, you know, for somebody who doesn't know Hawaii, how they were so close to nature, how they had fish ponds, and how they you know, navigated all of that you've brought in, which I assume is a part of the massive research that you've done, because you only live in Hawaii part of the time, right?
Yes, I was lived out there part-time for 20 years, but I've been on just about every corner of the Big Island, almost every place, at least every place in Hawaii that you read about in the book. I've been there. I've talked to people. One of the things that I do when I'm, quote, researching, which may mean just visiting and looking at a place and seeing how it can be fitted into a scene, I frequently take cell phone pictures of things that I think are likely to come out in the book so that I can really remember exactly what it looked like. And maybe it's a little sign, or maybe it's the location in respect to the trees or something that makes the scene more real. Because, you know, I've been there. It's not from Google Maps. It's not from some guidebook. It's sort of what I've seen and felt with my own presence.
Well, it's wonderful the way that you, I mean, this is a book. It's exciting. It's about a conspiracy. There's action. There's lots of twists, riveting twists and turns. And of course, you have the secondary story about Chief Detective Koekani's brother, which is also intriguing. So you've woven a really fascinating story here, and all that, you know, from that very first image that you create here in the very first pages is so shocking, but it carries through, I think, and the reader really cares about the story and wants to know what's going on.
You talked about research earlier. One of the really big research challenges for this book is part of the story of Koa's relationship with his brother, Ikeka, who is a former bad guy in the sense that he's been in and out of prison most of his life. He's was a juvenile delinquent that later becomes a serious criminal. He collapses in jail, and Koa slowly learns in the book that it may not be that his brother is just all evil. It may be that he had this medical problem that causes the collapse. And that becomes a very interesting, to me, interesting part of the story. But the research that went into the brain tumor that was ultimately what his brother is found to have had, and how it can affect behavior, and indeed how it relates to the research that's just really cutting edge today, that's based on the returning brain-injured servicemen who were in Afghanistan and Iraq. I did a lot of research on that to try to make this part of the story as real and as authentic as I possibly could. That was a real deep dive for me.
and you did a beautiful job. I was as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, yeah, this is, you know, at first I didn't know what was going on. And then as this unfurled here before us, I was very impressed with this part of the story. And I was, you know, happy. I think it's part of the thing of caring about Koakane. I mean, we care about him. We want something good to happen for him. And so I thought that was a wonderful way to bring in his brother, and I like that part of the story as much as I like the going after the bad guys, because we had some really bad guys there, and we're talking here about a problem that is a real problem, that there it's dangerous to build in parts of Hawaii, and as we saw, what year was it? We had all the was it 2 years ago, where we had all the lava flows that destroyed so much of so many homes there.
That was May 2018 when there was a huge explosion at the Kilauea crater, and as a result of the activity at that time, the lava. They think that we're talking about a billion cubic yards of lava. Think about that for a moment. A billion cubic yards drain out of the reservoir and explode in what's called the Lower East Rift Zone, which happened to have a community called Lulani Gardens. Most of Lulani Gardens was destroyed by the eruption there. And then the lava went through channels to the sea, where it overran a black sand beach, where it destroyed a beautiful bay. And as the lava pours into the ocean, it boils the seawater, and it throws up these huge clouds of what they call lave, L-A-Z-E, which is a mixture of hydrochloric acid and glass particles. So as I think I said in one point of the book, it's sort of hard to imagine a more realistic version of hell than this volcanic eruption, which really, really wrecked a beautiful portion of the island, but at the same time made the island bigger. It's what's been going on for centuries.
Well, you know, Bob, I want to tell people again that the name of the book is Fire and Vengeance. It's by Robert McCaw, and it's spelled M-C-C-A-W. It's a great book, a wonderful book to read, and I know that everyone will want to go back, and I noticed something, and I was very happy, and I know the writers who listen to me will be happy to hear. You published the very first book yourself, right?
Yes, I did.
When you did that, you know, and so for most people, for writers here, and they hear this story, well, if you're going to self-publish, and, you know, it can be like and the name of the book, as a matter of fact, was Death of a Messenger, and it can be the death of a writer's career. I mean, this is what some people think, that you publish a book yourself, and you'll never get a publisher. But I know that book did very well. People loved it. You got great coverage from other authors who love your writing, because it is top class. Your writing is just great. Of course, I will add that you're a lawyer, and there are so many wonderful lawyers who you know, it's just almost a natural thing that you turn out to be good writers. But now you have a publisher, and they are actually bringing out the first book again?
Yes. Far from being the death of a writer, my self-publishing of the first book, which I have to say I did in a first class way. I mean, I had the proofreaders, I had the copy editors. I mean, the book was really put together quite well mechanically. You can make your own judgment about the content, but that's what got me an agent. That book got me an agent, And once I had the agent, Mel Parker, who's just a phenomenal literary agent, he helped me get Ocean View as the publisher. And they published Off the Grid. They published Fire and Vengeance. And they're now going to reissue Death of a Messenger. So they'll have all three of the books. And in fact, I'm very close to submitting a fourth one in the Koa Kane series, which will take Koa yet off in another direction and tell you a little bit more about his history.
Well, you know, when book one comes out, I'd like you to come back on the program and we'll talk about that and all, because anybody who reads that first book would right away, if like this happens sometimes, you know, I get a book, I don't always know where it comes from. And so generally, this is what you said was the exact right thing, professionally done. You didn't skimp on having it done correctly, because if you're going to self-publish, take that little effort, because it's a business, and have it done right, because otherwise people won't treat you with the respect. But you got the respect that you deserve, and now you're going to have the success that you deserve, because with the book one, book and the whole series, and I'm sure there's going to be many, many more to come. I mean, you have now developed your own little franchise here, and with a wonderful character, somebody that we care about. He's not perfect, but we care about him. And Koa Kane is a character that once you read about him, once you know him, he's in your heart, you want more. And I know all of the listeners will want more once they read Fire and Vengeance, which is out today, and it's available wherever books are sold. And what's your website? Do you have a website?
Yes, it's www.robertbmccaw.com.
Okay. Well, Robert B. McCaw.
There's some blogs there. There's a lot of reviews there. There's some pictures. And you get to know a little bit more than you've seen in the books. And I update that with new material from time to time, related to the
books. Okay, because you are a photographer. Everybody, go to Bob's website and get this book and enjoy yourself. And whether you're indoors or outdoors, it's a great book to read right now this summer. Anyway, again, thanks, Bob, for being on the program today. And I'll have you back when book one comes out, okay?
Okay, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you and see your listeners.
Okay, bye-bye now. All right. Oh, that's nice. He's nice. And I only want to go to Hawaii because of him. I never wanted to go to Hawaii before. I'm going to go straight to my next my next book. I'm running a little bit late, so I want to apologize to Sharon Duckett. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Patsy. How are you doing today?
Okay, fine. Well, I'm sorry. I was running a little bit late. You know, this whole pandemic-y thing has sort of... I think we've all gotten a little bit, you know, disorganized. I don't know. I'm just trying to. I'm just back in the studio. I was out for a long time, broadcasting from my home, and so it's nice to be back. But so I'm sorry. I just got on with you a little late, but it's never too late for a book called No Rules. I guess we have no rules here. It's No Rules, a memoir, and it's by Sharon Duckett. And wow.
It's Duquette, actually.
And that's what I was just going to say. Well, why don't they tell me? I think Duquette is better. It's like, what's that English comedy? Bouquet.
Well, when I go to restaurants, it's so common that they mispronounce it that I just put an E on the end when I make reservations.
That's it. Yeah, that's what you need to do. That's it. Okay, so Sharon Duquett. Wow. It's a lovely cover here, a very hippie girl, because this is a story about a girl who was a hippie. I don't probably. You're still a hippie at heart, probably. I don't know.
In a lot of ways.
It never quite leaves you, right?
Yeah.
So, where do we start with this? No rules. We have no rules on where to start with this book. Wow. It's been described.
Should I start?
Yeah, you start.
I'll just start with giving a very, very brief overview about, you know, what the book is about. And it's about how I left home at 16 to join the hippie counterculture, which led to my awakening to feminism and my own strength. And I learned how to free myself from the rules that confined me.
Okay, so no, that's where we get no rules. But, I have mixed ideas about that, but you left home at 16, which is, you know, actually a pretty frightening thought for most people.
I've had that kind of feedback where, and even now I look, you know, I look at pictures of myself at 16 and I go, oh my goodness, I was such a child. and it really hit me, you know, looking back at those old pictures. It's just how young I was, even though at the time, of course, at 16, you think you know everything and you don't feel like you're young at all. So I was ready to take on the world, I thought.
Yeah.
And so I did.
Yes, so you did. But a lot of things happened to you. It's hard. With a book like this, you did a lot of things in your life. And it's funny how you went through so many sort of jobs and doing so many different things. I don't know where to start, really. But one thing, I mean, there is, when we're talking about hippie life, there were drugs, there was sex. So where do you want to go with this? How much do you want to tell people to sort of intrigue them into reading this book?
Would you like me to read an opening scene, perhaps? Would that be a good way to get started?
If you'd like to read, yeah, I love it.
Okay, why don't I read I'll read the first scene in the book, and this is the day that I'm running away from home. It takes place in January of 1971, in South Windsor, Connecticut. I slipped the floor-length dress I'd sewn from a purple Indian print bedspread over my head and pulled it down to cover the two pairs of long pants, three sweaters, and four pairs of underwear I'd put on moments before, then realized how huge my waist looked. If I didn't wear my coat to cover these clothes, my mother would realize something was wrong. I yanked my dress sleeves over all my other sleeves. If anything showed, I'd be screwed. While stuffing a pair of jeans and my fake suede jacket with a peace sign on the shoulder into a paper bag, I scanned the closet for my sandals. I'd need sandals in Southern California. I was certain it would be hot there, even in January. With my meager belongings stashed for my journey, I took a last brief look at my room, the room in which I'd spent 12 of my 16 years living in, and wondered how I could abandon all my things. The FM radio that my parents had given me for Christmas 3 weeks earlier, the guitar I had begged for when I was 12, my notebooks full of poetry I'd written over the last 4 years. Above my twin-sized bed was a poster I'd made with magic markers the previous spring, flowers and peace signs, forming a border around large decorative letters that read, "War is not healthy for children and other living things." "Don't get hung up on it," I coached myself. "It's only stuff." I crammed my arms into the sleeves of my brown corduroy winter coat and could barely bend them. Grabbing the paper bag and my school books, I dashed toward the kitchen, knowing my mother was waiting there to say goodbye before I left for school. I took a deep breath. "You're wearing your new dress," she sounded suspicious. I avoided eye contact. "I didn't realize you had finished making it." "Yeah, I finished it last night. I'm late for the bus. I have to go." I dove past her. "What's in that bag?" "Gym clothes," I shot back without turning around. "It's awful big for gym clothes. I've got to run, okay? Bye." I bolted out the side door and let it shut behind me, not looking back to see my mother for what might be the last time in my life. But I couldn't think about that. If I did, I couldn't leave, and I had to leave. This was my only opportunity. I knew she was standing by the door, following me with her eyes, that worried frown cemented on her lined, sad face. While closing the chain-link gate behind me at the end of our driveway, I recalled the dreams I'd had throughout my childhood where I tried to escape through this gate. I was always running with legs of lead that made me move in slow motion, trying desperately to run faster as long arms reached out to drag me back. I never knew what I was running from in those dreams, but I always awoke before escaping. I couldn't let that happen now. Dirty snow lined the road, remnants of yesterday's storm. I snickered at it. Sunny California, here I come, I thought. Only one last ride on the school bus. My heart raced, making me almost dizzy.
Flying on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be... Right? Was that in your head? Yes.
Something like that,
Something
California
like that.
Dreaming, oh, there were so many.
Yeah, okay. Well, that hit a lot of us. In your case, as you, well, first of all, you read very nicely. Are you going to be doing the Audible version of your book yourself?
If there is one, I still go back and forth about that. I probably would. I've heard it's recommended for memoir that you should read it yourself.
Yeah, I think so. You have a great voice. You read very nicely. I would do it.
Yeah.
And people do love them. And here was your audition. You passed. I think you should do it yourself. I think because it's there. The emotion is in your voice, and you need that when you're writing such a very personal. As you wrote in this opening scene, you took a look at your mother, and now as a reader, the book begins in a way as a little mystery, because we are always worried or wondering or thinking, and your mother, you know, it's mentioned in other places in the story, but this is part of what we wonder what's happening. And and of course, as a mother myself, I worry about, you know, about any 16-year-old running off. Although I started my life, also I was very adventurous, but certainly not in the way that you were. When you look back on it, are you happy that you did that? That this is how you found yourself?
Yes, because I know that I had to leave the environment that I was living in, because if I hadn't done that, I believe I would have just grown up to be a very fearful sort of person who would be afraid to kind of step out beyond my own very limited world. So it gave me, you know, doing all of that, all of the things that I did, gave me confidence.
Well, tell the listeners. I mean, some of the things that you did were very exciting. You saw, you know, whether you went to a concert and saw Mick Jagger, or you know that, but also the different jobs that you worked, the different places that you lived and worked. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well. When I first went to California, I was with my older sister. So you don't catch that from the very first scene, but you find that out in a later scene as I go to meet up with her. And she is 21, and the two of us drive to California. So while in California, we live off her savings and food stamps and manage to survive in that way. So I tried to get jobs out there, but... one thing I didn't realize at the time, because my understanding of the economy at that age was very limited, but there was actually a pretty serious recession going on around those years, and it was hard for people to get jobs. And one thing we discovered in California, for both of us, even though my sister had pretty good experience working in an insurance company, was that they didn't want to hire anyone who wasn't from California and didn't have experience working in California. And I'm sure it's probably because people were coming and going all the time. But I did, when I went to Boston after that, I got my first job, which was working at the Stop and Shop grocery store. And I was a cashier, and I did bagging, and I was really pretty bad at that job. So And it was very stressful too, because it was the busiest Stop and Shop of all. It's a pretty big chain now all over New England. I don't know how far it goes beyond New England. But at that time, it was the busiest Stop and Shop of all. And it was at the base of Beacon Hill in the Charles River Plaza, next to Massachusetts General Hospital. And every single person who lived on Beacon Hill shopped there. And Beacon Hill is pretty heavily populated. So it was very demanding, and I didn't know what I was doing. You know, you didn't get to scan things back then. You had to type in the numbers for each item that you had. You know, if you had a can of beans for 17 cents, you had to type in the 17 cents and hit beans, you know, this sort of thing. So it was...
You had to be able to think a little bit, because nowadays...
Yeah. So it wasn't quite, you know, and I'm not saying that cashier's jobs are easy nowadays. You know, I don't mean that, but some of the things that you had to do were a lot more involved. So that was I wasn't good at that job, and I was especially bad at bagging, and I'm still bad at bagging. I bag my own groceries sometimes, and I'm the worst bagger, because I just put everything in the bag, however it happens to end up on the checkout counter. So fortunately, that's not a skill I've ever developed. But after that, later on, as comes up in the epilogue, I processed medical claims, and I eventually went to technical school and became a computer programmer, just when things were really starting to get hot in the early 80s. And I sort of rode that wave of the computer industry right up until a couple of years ago, really. And I went into project management and management later on. So that's the summary of my work life. There were some other jobs in between there, too. Then.
Yeah.
Well, that would probably be another book.
You write very well. I mean, it's really excellent, a wonderful dialogue. And you know, a lot of you bring a lot of things about the 1970s back. Definitely, I think a lot of people from that generation will appreciate the book simply because you talk a lot about things that will, you know, sort of hit home.
Yeah.
And one of the things, of course, it's this women's lib coming alive, and all of the things that came out during those years, all the ideas, and of course you write about some of the books that influenced you, and just realizing that, women are equal. Of course,
I spend probably the first part of the book, a good chunk of the book, sort of showing the ways in which women weren't equal and the ways in which women were sort of used and abused and just not treated very well frequently. And then all of that leading up to when I discover the women's movement, that, wow, this explains a lot of things. You know, going right back to the life that my mother led and the things that she had to give up that were important to her. She had grown up wanting to be a concert pianist and was told by her male piano teacher that women can't be concert pianists. And,
I was thinking when I was reading about your mother that now talking about, since you are such an excellent writer, you could really turn her life into a novel.
Yeah, I thought about that, actually.
It's fascinating. Being British, marrying an American soldier, wanting to be a concert pianist. There are so many. When I was reading that, I will tell you that I was absolutely intrigued with your mother. Because I lived in England for many years, so I know England very well.
Okay.
I know, and I knew many people who lived through the war, and so I had a lot of contact with, and I still, I mean, I'm, I still like afternoon tea. You know, I was used to that. So I think you have perhaps a novel in your mother. It would be fascinating.
That's a possibility.
So
yeah.
Because once you learn how to write, as you have learned how to write so beautifully, I think that there's another book in you. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, and it's called No Rules by Sharon Duquette. You have a webpage, right? It's Sharon Duquette.
Yeah, SharonDuquette.com.
And it's spelled, if this is your real name, you must have been teased something awful. I didn't even think about it. See, I don't have a dirty mind, so I mispronounce
it. It's actually my married name. So.
Well, okay. So well, then your husband probably got teased a lot. But it's Duquette, D-U-K-E-T-T, and they can find you online, and I'm sure you are on Facebook and stuff. But it's a fascinating book. It's called No Rules, a memoir, and it's by Sharon, who's going to now write a novel about her mother who wanted to be a concert pianist, right? And then
will be doing that.
And you'll come back to Joy
on Paper. I'm actually writing another novel right at the moment, but that one, one I'll talk about another time.
Okay. Well, you do that. And thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye, Sharon.
For having me.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank Glenn Erickson again for supporting Joy on Paper, and we played his promo here. I'm so glad we got that in for Android Love. Special thanks to, of course, to Larson and Larson, Bill Larson, who is our legal eagle. He's going to be coming back to the studio in July. We wanted to keep everybody away that we could because you didn't know all the social contact business. But Bill will be back, and he will answer your questions. If you have an intellectual property question, go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com. Send it to me. I've got already a whole list of questions from listeners. And so Bill's going to be busy when he gets back here in the studio, and he'll answer your questions and help you make sure you... Because I've been hearing some really awful things that have been happening. And partly, I'm warning you people, don't put things on social media that are going to get you in trouble. And, of course, don't plagiarize anybody, because nowadays people can find it and they will sue you. And so you have to be really careful, and also be careful with the photos that you use on your website. But remember... One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series here on the Hallmark Channel. It could happen to you, but it won't unless you start writing. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He cleaned everything up, and everything is nice and spiffy here, and I want to thank him for that. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And everybody, have a nice day, a joy-filled day. Bye-bye.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 106.1